Welcome to The Insider, the members-only podcast featuring War on the Rocks authors. This show will explore in depth a featured article every week and why it matters for national security. My name is Nick Danforth, editor and host of the show. With that, let's dive in. We're here today with Joseph Steeb, an assistant professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and also the author of The Regime Change Consensus, Iraq and American Politics, 1990 to 2003. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
We're here to discuss Joseph's article, The War on Terror Was Not a Morality Tale, which was a review of Richard Beck's Homeland, The War on Terror in American Life. So I do want to talk about your review. I do want to talk about the book, but I wanted to start out a little more big picture here by talking about the whole challenge of writing about something as recent, something as politically sensitive as the War on Terror is history. I mean, I feel like the problem with history is if you write about something no one cares about, then no one's going to care about what you write, period. But if you write about something people care too much about, then in a different way, I mean, people are already going to have opinions about it that are so strong, it can often be difficult to break through and get them to care about the actual substance of what you're writing.
Absolutely. So a couple of challenges that come up, I think, in writing about the recent past, something as visceral and as high stakes as the War on Terror. One is that there are interesting generational dynamics at play. And part of the reason why I wanted to review this book is because Richard Beck's about my age. And the War on Terror clearly had a major influence on his politics and his approach to foreign policy. A lot of people have theories of the War on Terror that are fundamentally different than someone of the millennial generation. You know, I was just about old enough to kind of remember September 11th, I was 13 at the time, to want to pay attention to the larger context of things, but I didn't have very well-formed political viewpoints, right? So you do have to kind of challenge people with evidence and say, look, you know, you have your memory of this, but memory is not the same thing as history, right? History is sort of an aggregation of lots of different sources, including people's memories of things. I got some really good advice on writing about the recent past from my advisor, one of my advisors at UNC Chapel Hill. I was starting this, you know, my book on the 1990s and Iraq policy. And he said, write about this as if it was the 1890s, as if you're writing about sort of the political and policy and intellectual context that led to the Spanish-American War. Try to put yourself in a position where you are a little more detached from the emotion of it, from the relevance of it to contemporary policy debate. So I try to put the conversation about what does this mean for foreign policy second and put the history first. And unfortunately, I think that was one of my main issues with this book is that it did the exact opposite of that.
So before we get into the book, though, still, I have more questions on this. How do you even go about writing about something that is so recent that you did live through as if it was ancient? You know, relatively speaking, as if it was lost in the mists of time, as if it wasn't something that was so pressing.
A key step is to try to go from people using history to people kind of studying history in a disciplinary sense. So, you know, when an event happens, 9/11, 10/7, whatever event, there's the immediate tendency to kind of explain it in a way that is useful for whatever kind of policy agenda, political agenda, what we should do next. And that usually affects the first couple of waves of writing or, you know, historiography on a given topic, right? So you have to follow along with those narratives, try to figure out what has been said, right? So that you can jump in and say, okay, look, when people in, let's say, 2004 were saying the Iraq War was entirely about neocons, well, there was an agenda behind that, right? There was a usefulness to making that argument that you have to unpack, right? And then, you know, you can never fully escape that as a historian, but it's kind of your job to know what those narratives have been, what they've been used for, and how you can kind of break out of them. Frankly, mainly using primary sources, which is something that you get more access to over time.
And that was the other thing I was going to ask about. I mean, right, you're writing this at a time when the people who participated in it are still alive. The people who participated in it are still putting out their own memoirs about it, are still giving interviews or not giving interviews, which are represent a pretty decent sized chunk of the available primary source evidence base. How do you grapple with all of that in trying to do primary source research?
Well, first you have to put whatever people are saying in interviews and memoirs against available archival documentary sources. And then you have to, I think, be a little bit humble about the conclusions that you make. So, you know, a lot of books about the War on Terror or the Iraq War are incredibly certain about people's motivations, about the process of policymaking. I don't think it's remotely soon enough for us to be making certain statements about Bush administration's internal decision-making, the Obama administration's internal decision-making. We have fractions of the whole puzzle. Now, you can take parallels here to Cold War historiography, right? And how we had waves of this scholarship, and we're still going through that process as we expand who we consider to be the main actors in this conflict, whose archives we have access to, right? And so on. So I do take issue with a lot of books that make very grand sweeping claims about the war on terror that are hard to verify.
And your issue with this book that we're talking about here is actually not just they're making sweeping claims that can't be verified, but they're making sweeping claims that can actually are verifiably false.
I think it's both of those things. I think Richard Beck and I consider different things to be evidence, right? So if the war on terror, as he argues, was driven almost entirely by this calculation about restoring American economic hegemony, I would want to see that somewhere in a documentary record. I would want to see that being discussed in the planning process, maybe even in the memoirs or interviews with certain policymakers. Right? It's not enough to say this overarching goal was in the ether of the time and therefore must have been the cause. Right? I think Richard Beck very clearly wants this to be the cause of the war on terror, of the single thing that explains everything. For example, you get the Bush lied, people died narrative, which totally rips the conversation about WMD out of context. So I like to kind of divide the pre-war intelligence issues with Iraq WMD into two categories, right? There was the stuff that the Bush administration actually did exaggerate, kind of the irresponsible case they made, the evidence they conjured up from Iraqi exiles or from whatever dubious source. And then there was a larger body of some evidence, some suspicion, leftover issues from the 1990s that almost anyone involved in the debate, including foreign intelligence agencies, including the UN weapons inspectors themselves, believed signaled that Saddam Hussein either had something or was reinstituting his WMD programs. All right. So when you just dismiss all of that complexity as Bush lied, people died, you're totally erasing the actual history. My deeper underlying beef is it wasn't even a misrepresentation of evidence. It wasn't even a consideration of the evidence. I don't think this is a person who had read available intelligence reports, who had read books like Steve Cole's outstanding new book, other research by scholars who have dug into these archives and try to give us a better picture of the mistakes that we made. It's a preference for a morality tale rather than a really complex story that's hard to make black and white distinctions about.
And as you suggest with the discussion of the WMD evidence, you can tell a complex story and still reach moral judgments if you want. I mean, you can certainly understand the reasons that many people thought Saddam probably had weapons of mass destruction or believed a lot of the evidence and still criticize the administration for exaggerating the evidence that was available, maybe all the more so because the stakes were so high.
That can be said of the entire war on terror. I mean, I didn't write this article as a defense of the war on terror. I wrote it to critique certain narratives about it that I think are far too grand and homogenizing and simple. So, if, you know, for example, I kind of dispute this idea of the forever war. I don't think that's a really good paradigm for thinking about the war on terror. To me, that suggests there was one continuous logic that defined U.S. foreign policy the whole time, you know, across different conflicts or geographic zones, different administrations. To me, the Obama administration's war on terror was very different than the Bush administration's war on terror in terms of what they were trying to achieve, in terms of their ambitions, the ideologies behind it. I could say the same thing about Trump's war on terror. So when you make these very broad narratives, you create something that's politically useful, right? But you don't really capture the history.
So that brings me to my next question, which is where does this book in particular fit into the ecosystem, fit into the discussion, the bigger debate such as it is about the war on terror, and particularly the, and you describe it as restrainer, left-wing critique of U.S. foreign policy. You know, because I'll say, I think this is relevant. I mean, you first pitched this review to us and it seemed like a very compelling piece, but my initial response was, well, is this even a book worth arguing with? Is this even a book that is appealing, that is engaging with the conversation that people in Washington are having, or is it kind of out on its own making a case for an entirely different group of people who aren't going to be, you know, who precisely for the reasons because they're not reading the other books that would give more perspective on this, aren't going to be reading critiques of it that we might publish anyways?
It's a valid question, a valid, I guess, reservation about the book. I think it is influential in this narrative, is influential in sort of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I see people like AOC, Ilhan Omar, kind of putting forth a similarly simplistic narrative. I think that, you know, if the restraint, and of course I see Lindsay Institute put forth this all the time. If you go onto their website and search Forever War, right, you're going to get a lot of hits on these overarching narratives about the war on terror. People like Andrew Bacevich love this book because it confirmed everything they want to believe. I think it is important, not necessarily because I'm trying to deflate these two groups, right, engage in a war, a culture war against these groups, but because if they're going to be more effective, they have to be more cognizant of the complexities and challenges of policymaking, right? If they want to be throwing the keys to U.S. foreign policy, so to speak, they have to be willing to put themselves in the shoes of policymakers and understand the constraints and pressures that they operate under, right? It doesn't mean that they can't critique them. It means that the critiques have to be grounded in evidence and perspective, right? So in my way, I don't define myself as a restrainer, but this is kind of me trying to push them in a certain direction of moving from critique to a sense of responsibility. Like, how would I have fought the war on terror if I was Barack Obama in 2009, bringing in both political and policy issues?
And if you assume that the entire reason the war was fought was to achieve some broader, somewhat sinister financial hegemonic goals, then it's easy to answer that question because you just say, well, we wouldn't have had to fight the war on terror because we didn't have those sinister goals. Whereas you're suggesting that if you think of it as something that U.S. officials did in response to an actual threat that the American people, the voters, expected them to deal with, then you, in a sense, you can't bracket those hard questions. You have to find answers to them, which would be the answers that progressive foreign policymakers would have to be, you know, would be tasked with finding if they found themselves in power, and which they would ideally have to have answers to if they wanted people to vote for them to put them in power.
That's exactly right. And one of the strange things about this book is that the first half of it, which is better than the second half, is all about the experience of September 11th, how it changed our culture, you know, in ways that I think are overwhelmingly negative. You know, I think he actually does a good job with that part of the book. But then that sense of trauma and vulnerability, right, has nothing to do with U.S. foreign policy. It's like U.S. foreign policymakers are in this bubble where none of the fear and trauma of September 11th or the sense of entering a dark new world affected them. It made me kind of go back and look at Mel Leffler's book, which I've been pretty critical of. But he captures the context of post-9/11 policymaking extremely well, right? How responsible they felt to the country, how they believed that his presidency would be over if there was a second major terrorist attack, how angry they were about this, right? Sometimes foreign policy isn't driven by grand schemes and, right, by grand strategies. Sometimes it's driven by emotion. And I think that post-9/11 is a huge illustration of that.
I think I was actually at an event at, this might have been Cato rather than the Quincy Institute, in which this subject was being discussed in relationship to the U.S. war against ISIS. And a former administration official who'd been involved in crafting that response at some point somewhat got a little frustrated with the conversation and said, you know, the American people did want us to respond to ISIS. Like, this was something they were really expecting us to do. And the idea that people's emotional response to terrorism, which is, after all, something that's designed to create an emotional response, was not part of the equation or wasn't something that factored into U.S. policy. Just, you know, like you said, I mean, misses a chance to engage with the reality, the complexity of the subject.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to plug my second book project for a second. Working on a book about how conservatives have understood and interpreted terrorism since the 1960s. So it's not necessarily a history of counterterrorism policy, it's a history of ideas and counterterrorism. And one thing that to me comes up over and over again in their thinking and writing and advocacy is that terrorism is a sign of a morally disordered world, right? The fact that people could, I guess, lower themselves to stoop to these means to achieve change is a sign that either American domestic society, like going back to the Weather Underground, has totally lost its moral foundations, right? Or that the world is literally spinning into chaos when you apply it internationally. So a sense of trying to recreate order, moral order and international order, is fundamental to the way Americans have thought about terrorism for a long time, right? And so when you portray policymaking the war on terror as this big scheme to reinstate American economic hegemony, you're missing people, not just as emotional actors, but as moral actors, right? Who, you know, believe the United States has a moral responsibility to crush terrorism. That can create blinders for policy. I think it did create blinders, but it's absolutely there as a motive.
But this also, I feel like, is something else about the left-wing critique of American foreign policy, that whereas in the past, I think a prevailing critique was that you might have had well-meaning people who made big mistakes. I mean, this was the Quiet American, the whole that criticism of U.S. foreign policy, that it was idealism that led us astray in many situations. I feel like so much of what the contemporary left critique is pushing back on that or rejecting that and saying, you know, if bad things happen, it has to be because people had bad intentions, in really trying to deny that there's any possibility that well-meaning people could have done anything wrong, which is certainly at odds with my reading of history. It sounds like yours as well.
Yeah, I think that's a form of moralism. I think that the Bush administration in particular made horrible mistakes. I think they made unethical decisions, right? I think the decisions on torture and detention that and other authors have gone into a lot of detail on, they were absolutely wrong in those decisions, right? And hurt America's moral credibility in the world. But, you know, whether you're a conservative saying that the essence of America is good or a left-winger saying the essence of America is bad, either way, you're creating a morality tale, right? And I think, again, going back to Mel Leffler's book, right, he's looking at a lot of people, including George Bush, who I think has a very strong moral conscience, through a mix of motives and emotions, dragging the country into disaster, right? And I think that that's a harder story to moralize about, right? But it's a more human and I think more accurate story.
On that note then, just to conclude, in your research, in the debate in general, what do you think are the big questions about the war on terror that historians are wrestling with or on the verge of getting answers to, that historians should be trying to get answers to?
I'll give you two. So the first is, to what extent did September 11th transform American foreign policy? Or, you know, were there legacies of American foreign policy and the way we thought about the world and ourselves that we absolutely have to look at from pre-9/11 to understand what we did in September 11th? That's not a binary thing. There's obviously room on both sides. I think the initial reaction after 9/11 was, we're in a totally different world. Everything's off the table. You know, Richard Armitage said to a Pakistani counterpart, history begins today. Right, that was the mentality with which a lot of American policymakers approached the post 9/11 world. As we've moved past that, got a little distance from the past, we can say, okay, but there are actually a lot of continuities between the way we thought about terrorism and our role in the world pre 9/11 and post 9/11. So I think figuring out the balance between those things is what I'm working on right now in my second book, and is what a lot of scholars should be asking. And then the second is to try to figure out, you know, maybe this is more of a policy thing, but what parts of the war on terror actually worked in enhancing our security and what parts didn't? I always kind of think, what if the United States had fought the war on terror exactly as it did, but you took the Iraq war out of it, right? Would it really have been that much of a disaster? You know, we were not attacked again in a catastrophic way like we learned September 11th. We significantly degraded the capacity of Al-Qaeda. We eventually did the same thing with the Islamic State. Although in a way that was a consequence of our own actions, right? So that's a dubious kind of victory. You know, I think the Iraq war overshadows so much of the war on terror. It's hard to kind of back up and say there were things that we maybe got right. That's a tougher balance. You know, I think when you try to kind of remove your moral blinders a little bit, right, you can get at that more and that makes you more useful to a policymaker. Whereas if you just have this blanket, it was all a giant atrocity. It was all a hegemonic campaign. You're not helping it.
Look forward to seeing your next book. We continue to try to get articles addressing the very question that you just asked. If anyone's listening and has strong thoughts on that, by all means, send us a pitch. But in the meantime, thank you so much for the article and for coming on to talk about this.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.